behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
I'm Ben. We are joined, as always, by our super producer. So shout out to Noel Toucans Brown.
Toucans. Like the bird?
No. So cans is a slang term that we use around here for headphones.
Oh, I thought it was like Toucan Sam on the, was it Fruit Loops, I think it is?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I guess it'll work either way, though.
It could work either way.
Yeah.
It could work, but that guy hates birds.
Well, he's an audio engineer, so I guess we'll go with toucans, like the two words, toucans.
And, of course, we leave it up to you. Ultimately, your opinion is the one that matters the most when it comes to this show. We also, of course, we'll find a nickname for our super producer, Dylan Fagan.
I'd like you to think about this one ahead of time, though.
Okay.
Screaming Chicken. It fits with today's topic.
It does. Dylan, I know you're listening, so hang on. Just give us a chance. You'll see how it all works out.
It's like a passive-aggressive nickname that I gave Dylan right there. You know? It falls right into place with this topic.
Yes.
But to call some guy that I work with a Screaming Chicken... Yeah, that's a little bit aggressive. That's
a little pushy.
I think it is, yeah. I mean, hope he doesn't take offense to that. Maybe we'll come up with something better between now and then.
Yeah, well, we should keep our options open because he is our editor.
Well,
you know what I mean?
Can't come up with anything worse, I guess, at this point. So,
but we do have another person that we need to mention at the beginning of this podcast.
Yes, this was a listener suggestion, and it comes from Andrew S. Andrew S. also goes by the name... Brisket Turner, and I like that. Brisket Turner.
Brisket.
All right, so Andrew writes in and he says, oh, you know what, this is pretty recent, from February of 2017, but this one piqued our interest right away.
Mm-hmm.
He says, hey, Ben and Scott, I've been listening to your podcast for about 2 months now. You guys do a great job explaining stuff on cars that I didn't know. For example, your podcast, How to Make a Car Last $300,000, or 300,000 miles.
Mm-hmm.
$300,000, that'd be nice. How to Make Your Car Last 300,000 Miles. I now drive differently because of it.
That's so cool.
Also, he's adopting some of our, what would you call it, ginger tactics, maybe?
Observations.
I guess the way to look, like to drive your car kind of softly. I don't know how
yeah.
I'd better say that.
Yeah, because in that episode, we talk about how much the way you handle driving matters over time. You know, like sudden stops and starts mm-hmm. will eventually punish the machine.
Oh, sure, like cold start. Well, of course, cold starts, you can't avoid that, but revving the engine excessively when it's still cold, et cetera. All that stuff, that all adds up. So he's driving his vehicle differently now. He's got a 2003 Chevy S10 with 209,820 miles on it, and he got it from his best friend's dad for free.
Can't beat the price.
That's the best kind of car, right? Mm. He says there are other problems with it. He mentions all kinds of stuff like there isn't a heater or an AC. The ignition doesn't want to work half the time and some other minor things too. But honestly, hang in there. That's a great car to own. Don't worry about it. It's a good looking vehicle too. He sent in about 6 photos.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thrust of today's program. I was wondering if you guys could do an episode about Pontiac Trans Am. The one, he says specifically, the one from the Smokey the Bandit movie. I know you've kind of covered it in the episode The Best Car Chases, Part 1 or 2, but if you could do a review on the Trans Am, I would greatly appreciate it. Thanks for all the podcasts, Andrew S. And, Andrew, that's a fantastic idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you said specifically the one from the Smokey and the Bandit episode. We're going to talk about all Trans Ams, including that one. And I think we are going to start with the very genesis of the Trans Am nameplate.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes all the way back to the late 1960s, so we'll get there. We will eventually make it to the 1977. And I think the tactic that Ben and I talked about ahead of time, or one that I maybe forced on Ben, I don't know, we'll find out, is that there is so much minutia in between. In between 1969, when this thing originated, and 1977, and then later, this car went until 2002.
Right.
Ran until 2002. So, long time. 34 years of production. So much detail. We're going to kind of focus on just a couple of little bits here and there, and hopefully, some of the details, if you're really, really intrigued by this one,
mm-hmm.
you can focus in on a specific model year if, you knew somebody that owned one, or if you own one yourself. The details are just really tough to get for 34 years of production.
There's a lot here.
So we're going to hopefully make this a compelling story. I hope so. We're off to a slow start. but we'll try to make it interesting for you along the way. And, I think maybe... And I know this is jumping ahead, and then we'll go back. But the one that he's talking about, the Smokey and the Bandit Trans Am, that's really the one that, that brought it to like into pop culture, I guess, into to people's minds. That's the one that a lot of people think of when they think of Trans Am. And that was a 1977 movie that was directed by a guy named Hal Needham. He was a stuntman, and it was a, his directorial debut, as a matter of fact. Here's the thing. In 1977, this was the second largest grossing film, right behind, guess what? Star Wars. Star Wars came out the exact same year. It would have been number one had it not been for the release of Star Wars that exact same year. So bad timing on that front, but it was a wildly popular movie. Big success. Of course, Burt Reynolds, Sally Field, Jerry Reed, Jackie Gleason. There's a bunch of big names in Hollywood at the time in this film.
And it launched a franchise.
It really did. This was a huge thing. This is really big for, well, of course, there's a lot of, what do you call it afterwards? Marketing, I guess, when they have a lot of products that they sell afterwards.
Merchandising.
Hats and, merchandising. T-shirts, hats, you know, tattoos. I don't know. Just a lot of stuff that they had. You know, they had drink cozies and, you know, whatever, keychains, all that kind of stuff. But this was really, really big for Pontiac. It was an excellent product placement on their part.
Yeah, can we give just a brief overview of the plot? I'd love to set it up.
Oh, yeah, sure, of course.
So it's it starts with bootlegging. And we did an episode on bootlegging also, or we did an episode on how Prohibition led to racing, right? Mm-hmm. And in Smokey and the Bandit, there's this wealthy guy from Texas and his kid, and they're looking for a bootlegger who is going to smuggle Coors beer to Georgia, essentially. Mm-hmm. That's how it starts. And that sounds kind of crazy, maybe nowadays, because Coors is not, you know, in the world of craft beer or whatever, Coors is not as highly regarded as, you know, no one's saying it's terrible or anything, but
it's a common off-the-shelf product.
There we go.
Yeah.
Perfect. So, like, why would you smuggle it?
Why would you smuggle it from Texarkana, Texas to Atlanta, Georgia, and have only 28 hours to make it there? That's the whole thing. That was the premise of the story, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was like hundreds of cases of this stuff, right? In a full, it was a full semi truck, and of course, the semi truck was driven by Jerry Reed, who went by the name Cletus in the movie, and Burt Reynolds played the Bandit. His traveling partner, I guess, would be Carrie, Sally Field, and along the way, of course, one of my favorite characters, the Jackie Gleason character. Buford T. Justice. Sheriff Buford T. Justice, who was in hot pursuit the whole time.
Right.
And, it's just some fantastic scenes. So, it's a funny movie. It's definitely a gearhead movie. It's fun to watch looking back because you can appreciate this 1977 Trans Am, you know, and other, ancillary characters, I guess, if you want to call them that, you know, the extras, I suppose.
Right.
The extra cars along the way. There were a lot of them. And, again, Pontiac, placed these, I don't know if you can call it placed, but I guess Pontiac offered these vehicles for the use in the film. There were two Trans Ams, 1977, and then there were also a couple of, I believe there were two four-door Pontiac Le Mans sedans that they also offered up for this production as well. Now, the Trans Ams, of course, were destroyed during the filming. One was completely destroyed during that infamous bridge jump that they did. Mm-hmm. That was the end of one of them. And the other one was just kind of along the way beaten up really badly. Some other interesting stuff about that when we get to the 1977 model, I guess. But you want to take a step back, Ben, and maybe talk about the birth of the Trans Am and
find Genesis? Out,
yeah, where it came from.
Yeah.
It's an interesting story, too. I hadn't really – okay. Full disclosure here, I had, and I think everybody knew this, I had a Trans Am. That was my first car.
Yeah.
I had a 1978, and I, at the time, I'll tell you, I was ignorant about the car mostly at the time, other than I really appreciated it in the movie, just like a lot of people did, you know, in the, the Smokey and the Bandit films. But at the time, I was a kid in high school. I didn't care to look up the history. I didn't have the internet really to, you know, to just at any whim look up any kind of information I wanted about it. And, you know, production numbers, et cetera. All that stuff had to be found in books and library.
Yeah, we're talking microfiche.
And I was, you know, I was staying away from that place at the time.
Yeah, you were a hothead.
Driving around town in my hot-rodded Trans Am. So, anyways, I wasn't, like, really focused on, you know, the original engines and all that, you know, like all the codes that went along with everything and keeping everything original. And I just wasn't focused on that. I knew it was a cool car and it was fun. Maybe more on that later. But Anyways, this thing goes all the way back to 1969, and I guess we can start there. This begins with a racing series called the Trans-Am Series, and it wasn't originally called the Trans-Am Series. It was originally called the Trans-American Sedan Championship, which started in 1966.
Mm-hmm. And there's something interesting here because even before this series, during the 60s, GM, General Motors, was using the term Firebird for some of their concept cars.
Mm-hmm.
So it was already in the zeitgeist, the concept. But as you said, and as a lot of people might not know, the Pontiac Firebird comes from racing.
Yeah, that's right. It was okay. Here's the twisted tale of this whole thing, and it's not really all that twisted. It's that Camaro was first, Firebird was kind of birthed from that, mm-hmm. and then from the Firebird came the Pontiac Firebird Trans Am, and that we'll talk about that progression in just a moment. But in 1966, when the SCCA president, who at the time was named John, well. He was always named John, but his name is John Bishop. He was the president of the SCC at the time. Mm-hmm. And he created this new racing series. And it was, again, as I said, it was normally or originally called the Trans-American Sedan Championship. But they changed it to just the Trans-Am Series soon after. And there were two categories of racing. And this is important because mm-hmm. there were two classes, maybe. That's a better way to say it. There are many, many classes now. But there was the under 2 liter group. And then there was the over 2 liter group, but the over 2 liter group was limited to 5 liters. Now, what that did at that specific time in history is that it allowed pony cars to compete.
Mm-hmm.
And so who was building pony cars at the time? That was Ford. Of course, GM answered with the Camaro and, of course, the Firebird. The Firebird was the one for competition, really. And then even later, we'll talk about, where the Trans Am came from, but, homologation rules that were tied to this series resulted in a lot of these offerings being provided for people out on the street. They could buy these on the showroom and drive them on the streets. Mm-hmm. These were cars that were race cars for the SCCA Trans Am series back at the time. And these included, like, Camaro. Well, Chevy had the Camaro Z28 at the time, which was brand new again, I think, in 1967. That was the first year for that one. Ford had the Boss 302 Mustang. For 1970, I think there was the Barracuda AAR, which stands for, I think it's All American Racing. And there was only 1 year of that, again, 1970. Mm-hmm. There was the Challenger TA, AMC had, Javelins. There were all kinds of cars competing in the series at the time. And of course, Pontiac wanted to kind of up the game, I guess. So starting in 1966, they were already in there in some way with Chevy was not Pontiac, mm-hmm. But Pontiac also wanted to jump in there, and that was the focus, the directive, I guess, from John DeLorean.
Yes, that is true. Once again, John DeLorean graces the car stuff world because this is, I know what you're thinking, ladies and gentlemen, and you are correct. This is the same DeLorean who started the ill-fated DeLorean Motor Company.
Yeah, later racked with scandal, but not mm-hmm. right now. Right now, he's still the good guy. He's still he's still the guy on the white horse at this point, right? So, GM, he was general manager of Pontiac Division from 1965 until 1969, but he didn't start there. He started at Packard Motor Company. He then eventually went to Pontiac to become the division head in 1965. And then in 1969, he moved on to Chevrolet, and then by 1973, he went to, DeLorean Motor Car. He went to start DeLorean Motor Car Company, which, again, only lasted until about 1982 before they went bankrupt. But he is the genesis of the Trans Am project, really. When he was division head of Pontiac between 1965 and 1969, right around, you said it earlier, 1967, Ben, that is when he decided that he was going to create this group, this new effort, I guess, to race in the series competitively, and they created something called the Pontiac Firebird Sprint Turismo Project, and it started to, it's called PFST, and that started to kind of get mentioned, I guess, more often. People knew about it as early as mid-1967. Mm-hmm. So within the next year or so, they decided that, the V6 power was something that was going to have to go. There's no way that, you know, this car is going to be competitive in the series with the V6 power. So they didn't quite know exactly what they were going to do with it yet, but they said, you know, it's going to have a V8 engine. Mm-hmm. They also wanted to have some external body modifications, something that, you know, would make it better on the track, something that was actually functional on the track.
Right. These are not ornamental enhancements, you know what I mean? They partnered with the car designer and builder, a guy named Gene Winfield, and ultimately, the improvements that he made found their way into one of the two palladium silver 1969 prototypes.
Yeah. Now, I have something to say about these prototypes. There were two built.
Yeah.
One was, as we say, lost to time. We don't know where one of them went.
It's in a barn somewhere.
It's gone. Well, I don't know. It seems like it'd be found, but you never know. These things turn up, right? There is a story about the second one, because the second one for a while was... I'll call it semi-lost. Some people knew where it was, but not everybody knew where it was.
Right.
And there's a really good, I guess you call it a resurrection story, of the second Pontiac Trans Am prototype. And this was the one that was owned by, well, it was actually the private vehicle of a guy named Jerry Titus, who was a race car driver, for Pontiac back in the day. And he kept it as his own personal vehicle until about 1970. And then he sold it off to a guy, a private collector, I think somewhere in Kentucky. I can't remember exactly where in Kentucky, but it was owned by this guy in Kentucky. And then later it was bought by a car collector when it came up for sale. His name is Kurt Richards. And Kurt Richards completely restored this thing. And you can watch the story of this on it's not a very long video. It's 22 minutes long. If you find this one, it's 22 minutes and 5 seconds. It's called The Trans Am Story. Just search on YouTube. You'll find it. It is very, very interesting. There's a few sound bites from the son of Jerry Titus. You know, he's the one who verified that this was the original, that, you know, these parts that they were finding on the vehicle were definitely the parts that that Gene Winfield, the guy that you had mentioned, Ben, earlier, that mm-hmm. created these aftermarket parts, or these go-fast parts. I don't know what you kind of want to call them. Maybe like exterior body panels and things out of fiberglass and all that for the prototype. They all verified that, you know, this is the car. It was the Trans Am prototype, the lost Trans Am prototype. So it's an interesting tale if you have 22 minutes and 5 seconds to watch it.
If you can dedicate the time.
Yeah. Well, if you can dedicate the 4 hours that it's going to take for us to get through this this episode, apparently. No, I'm just joking. It's not going to take 4 hours. We'll try to condense it.
I think we're doing all right here, because we're looking at the early days, right, of the Trans Am, and
yeah, the first days.
And one thing we know for sure is that in that first decade, the Trans Am was already taken off. You know, I'll jump ahead a little bit. By 1979. They were making over 100,000 cars a year, almost 120,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that number is going to come into play in just a minute, because I'm going to have a little a dollar amount that is attached to that 117,000 number in just a moment. But first, I think we should take a word from our sponsor.
And we are back. Before the break, we teased some numbers that'll come into play in 1979, but I think we need to journey back in time for a second.
Just a little bit, and only for a moment, because I just wanted to mention that the actual reveal of this vehicle was December 8th of 1968, and they call that a mid-year Trans Am release. Mm-hmm. So mid-year is when this thing was debuted or unveiled, and it was debuted alongside the brand new GTO Judge package that they had introduced, just to kind of draw attention or revitalize, mm-hmm. you know, the GTO mm-hmm. in some way. And I think the Judge package did just that. But that was at Riverside International Raceway. And there were a lot of media on site. And, you know, there was one prototype, and there was also a white and blue pre-production version that was on site as well. I think that's the one that was lost. That must be, right?
Yeah.
The other one was silver, the prototype we're talking about. But for that first year, again, it was a mid-year release, there were only 697 regular production units that came off the line in that first year. So it's a very low production first year for a Trans Am. So if you see one of these available, those are the ones to grab. If they truly are a 1969 Trans Am, it's one of only 697 built. But as you mentioned, Ben, by 1979, that number had swelled to 117,108. Mm-hmm. Now, This is important. Here's the dollar amount that I had kind of teased a little bit before. Here's something I again, when I was a kid and I had a Trans Am, I had no idea this was going on. So you would think that, you know, there's a car named the Trans Am. There's the series named the Trans Am. What's the tie-in? Well, you know, we know that it raced in the series, but Pontiac was the one that went the farthest with this. And they said, we're actually going to name our product the Trans Am.
Right.
However, the SCCA thought, well, that's nice, but, you know, we're going to have some kind of licensing agreement with you. And it was a pretty big one, a pretty hefty fee, I guess, because each car, each Pontiac Trans Am that came off the line, via this offer, this deal, I guess, that was penned between SCCA and Pontiac somewhere between 1970 and 1971,
mm-hmm.
amounted to $5 per car that came off the line with the Trans Am nameplate.
So by the time they get to 1979 and they have those 117,108 cars, this means that SCCA gets a check for over $500,000.
Yeah, we're almost $600,000 for that 1 year, just for 1979. So they've been producing these ever since. Now, I did the inflation calculator thing, if you're interested in this.
Oh, yeah.
So I went with the 1979 number because that was probably the way to go, I guess. So 1979, $5 was the equivalent of $16.78 today. So if we extrapolate that $5 in 1979 that amounted to almost $600,000,
mm-hmm.
in today's money, that would be a nearly $2 million check. I mean, it's just under $2 million. So that's what type of money we're talking about just from the production of one product or one vehicle meant for the SCCA. That was huge money for them, and it really helped them. It went a long way in, as it says, easing some financial issues that that organization had at the time. I can imagine.
Right, because at this time in history, the glory days of the series are, you know, in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So they're at a point where every little bit helps.
Although, I guess you could say that. I suppose so. SCCA is still wildly popular.
Yes.
The Trans Am series is still in existence. You know, they've been around since 1966. You can still go to the Trans Am series and check out, you know, what they're doing today. So it's still around. But you're right. I think there was kind of a glory day era that had long gone at that point by 1979. And, you know, maybe I'm sure along the way there were points that recaptured some of that magic, but maybe not as much as the late 1960s, early 1970s.
I guess it's fair to say that at the very least they were at kind of a lull at that time.
Oh, that's a good way. That's a perfect way to say it, Ben. So maybe how about this?
Yeah.
Maybe we should talk a little bit about the engine of this vehicle.
Oh, and, I've been waiting for this.
Just a little bit of the 69, and then we'll move on. We'll get to the 77, maybe some other related stuff.
Okay.
But let's talk about the engine that was offered in 1969.
Okay, the engine that was offered in 1969. So, again, this was a limited production special, right? As is often the case.
Well, every single one of those Trans Ams was considered a special unit.
Which means that it gets some extra TLC in the performance department. So they'll have a couple of extra, like, top-shelf equipment components. The standard engine was the Ram Air 3 version of the 400 cubic inch V8, and this was the 400 HO with functional Ram Air.
High output.
Awesome. High output. Yeah, and though this was new to Pontiac in 69, the core of the engine dated back to 67, so it still had some stuff. I don't know how deep you want to get into this, Scott.
Yeah, maybe not too deep. We don't need to go into the full specs in this whole thing. It's just that it had some extras. It had some, I guess, a little bit more performance tuning that went along with it. And,
right.
I mean, we're talking about things like, you know, it still had the same compression ratio. It had, you know, a quadrajet-style four-barrel carburetor, the same carburetor as the base 400 of 1969. But there were, you know, other stuff that was a little bit different. Like the block was drilled for four-bolt main caps,
mm-hmm.
Even though it had two-bolt caps installed. There's a hotter camshaft, so you can imagine it was a little lumpier cam, you know, a little more performance-oriented cam.
And that the air induction system and the exhaust manifolds were redesigned, which all of which...
cast iron, by the way.
Cast iron, by the way, yes.
That was the time.
It was a time when people weren't as worried about weight. but this leads us to one significant thing, which I think a lot of people who are fans of Trans Ams have noticed, and you probably noticed when you were driving yours. Although the paperwork will say this is around 335 horsepower,
mm-hmm.
that's probably...
Well, it's a conservative estimate.
Conservative is a nice way to say it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because that was supposed to be only 5 more horsepower than the base model 400 engine. So you know that with all the extra add-on stuff that they had done to this, that, you know, that's definitely a conservative estimate. They were trying to kind of underrate the thing on paper so that maybe it was a, I don't want to say a sleeper, but it had a lot more power than you might think.
Mm-hmm.
So if you wanted to up that even more, you could select, there was an optional 400 Ram Air 4 selection that you could make. However, only 55 of those 697 Trans Ams built were ever equipped with the Ram Air 4.
Yeah.
And they were all installed in the coupe bodies. And that's because I think it was kind of an expensive option.
It was almost $600.
Yeah, it was $600 at that time.
Yeah.
It was a lot of money. So, yeah, it cost a lot to add that. But here's the thing. You know, there were. This is the one that's most desirable to collectors as well. There were a lot of differences between this one and, you know, the internal components, I guess I should say.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, cylinder head design being one of those, but the factory rating on this thing was 345 horsepower at 5,400 RPM. Now, you have to take into account, however, that this engine was also the same engine that they used in the GTO in the same year. And it was rated around 370 horsepower. So, and that one they said was underrated as well. They had kind of backed that one down on paper. So, you can kind of see what's going on here. I don't know. What would you say? They underrate them purposely again.
Right.
So that, and I don't know if this is like, this is pre-EPA days. So
sure.
It wasn't that wasn't the concern. This might have just been trying to, snowball the competition, you know, maybe, again, a little bit of
sandbagging.
Sandbagging. That's what I'm thinking of. Yeah.
Yeah.
So probably a little bit of that too. So, interesting tactics that they had. Now you might be also surprised to learn that these Trans Ams, I guess the base form of the Trans Am
mm-hmm.
came with a 3-speed manual transmission. Now it sounds a little funny these days to have a 3-speed manual, but that was not all that uncommon. As a floor shifter, of course, it was a heavy duty unit.
Yeah.
But very few actually were delivered with that gearbox intact. So
yeah, the majority actually came with the optional Muncie wide ratio 4-speed.
Yeah, that's right. And that same Muncie, that 4-speed, was also offered on the Ram Air 4. In fact, on the Ram Air 4, that was the only option you could get. And Pontiac was also willing to fit a 3-speed turbo hydromatic automatic against either of the Ram Air engines, you know, on the option chart. If you wanted the automatic, you could get it.
Mm-hmm.
A 3-speed automatic. Which it wasn't terrible. Wasn't great, wasn't terrible.
Was it the best?
Well, it wasn't the best.
So, it's weird because you can tell now already in the beginning there were clear differentiations between Firebirds, right? And not all Firebirds were created equally. Sometimes you'll hear automotive historians refer to things as, you know, lesser Firebirds, which is weird to hear.
But, yeah, well, I mean, I guess you could, if you wanted to look at the pecking order, if you want to call it that, it would be, you know, Camaro, Firebird Trans Am. If you want to call it Firebird, you could just call it Trans Am if you wanted to.
Yeah.
If you wanted to, like, place it in order that way, that's typically the way it went. And again, that kind of depended on how you had your Firebird option and how you had your Trans Am option. You could kind of pick and choose and kind of make these a little better, a little bit stronger in some areas. I think everybody gets the idea that, you know, if you're ordering your own vehicle, you can really kind of go out on a limb as long as you have the money to back that up, right? You can order
right.
just about any option. You could order the police package for a lot of cars too, and then made them. You know what? Let's move on because I'm going to get into a rabbit hole here that I don't want to get into.
Do you want to talk about the chassis?
Maybe a little bit. All right. So this is the thing that the Trans Am didn't necessarily deviate from the general Firebird underpinnings. However, they had a few really discreet but significant upgrades that made this a special product, you know, something unique.
Yeah, yeah. So Herb Adams, a racer and a guy well known as a suspension expert, had earlier said that the soft rubber bushings were allowing unwanted deflection, especially in steering control
mm-hmm.
and feedback when you had larger wheels and tires. So,
and of course the Trans Am did.
Yeah, and of course the Trans Am did. So they used some high-density control arm bushings to combat this from the mandated addition of 14x7-inch wheels. So that sounds like a small thing, but it makes a difference in handling.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's exactly right. Everything was about track performance, right? So things like this is a terrible name for the brakes. High-effort power front disc brakes. Now, when you say high-effort power front disc brakes, it makes it sound like you have to put in the high effort
right.
in order to make them work.
Yeah.
I think that was not what they meant. These are high effort. They're putting out high effort. So power front disc brakes with single piston calipers, heavy-duty coil springs, hydraulic shocks, and again, the high-effort variable ratio power steering box were included. Now, again, I would drop the high-effort part of that if it was me.
Yeah.
Also, this is pretty significant, too. There was a 1-inch diameter anti-roll bar with improved end links that contributed to greater corner stability in the front end. And, of course, the front end being completely revamped, they had to do something to the back end, so they
right.
included heavy-duty versions of the rear semi-elliptic multi-leaf springs, and they also had staggered hydraulic shocks. And you could also get a safety track, well, something called this, I think this is a brand name, but safety track, limited slip differential. I think the standard was also finned cast iron drum brakes at the back. So, again, still drum brakes at the back, but discs at the front. And if you wanted to, Pontiac offered Koni adjustable shocks as optional equipment. You could get other optional equipment too, and I find this one pretty interesting. You could get what was really popular, these rally two wheels, and then there was also an option for wire wheel covers, and get this, a single buyer opted for that. So there was one of them made with wire wheels in 1969. But you know what? It's funny, but that makes it valuable.
Yeah, because it's the only one.
I know. Isn't that strange? It's like those little things, like just something small like that. If you were to find that original one, that would be worth something because of that.
Scarcity is weird, man.
It's a strange thing. It might not be the most desirable feature. You know, I mean, maybe it is. I don't know. But it just seems like, you know, little things like that really add up in auction value.
So can we hop inside the vehicle real quick?
Yeah, sure.
I just want to look at some of this stuff. As you know, this is a pony car, which means that there's an emphasis on performance. A Rolls-Royce, this is not.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not intended to be. So the interior of the Firebird really depended on the package you went with. But what was standard was upholstery called Marokide, and a formula-style steering wheel was added later on.
Marokide. Is it like Corinthian leather?
Yeah.
I wonder. I mean, I wonder what that is, really. But I have to check out a 69 Trans Am.
Now, you could go up. You could go up a step and get, you know, wood grain inlay around the instruments, a passenger side. The real word is assist grip, but I think we all know what they're actually called.
Yeah, we know what those are. The handles.
Yeah, the O handles.
Yeah, exactly.
So then they have vinyl seating surfaces, door panels, and rear side panels with armrests that you could get. And they would have, you know, some more, I guess, aesthetic things, you know, like a molded trunk mat or rail garnish or side rail garnish moldings, right?
Yeah.
Only 6 people got the folding rear seat.
Well, there you go. Another valuable option, right?
I wonder if Wire Wheels guy, that's who he is in my head.
So if he has wire wheels and a folding rear seat, I wonder if that would be anything. But you know what I find most interesting maybe is the outside, of course, because they had, you know, there were... well, we'll talk about the decals and stuff like that, too. But there was a 60-inch wide rear deck spoiler, which actually provided downforce at higher speeds. And the paint, I mean, that's something that a lot of people focus on, too. There was a paint called Cameo Ivory Paint that was trimmed with something called Tyrol Blue, which were dual racing stripes. And they also had this really cool, I mean, if you look at the hood, these are really easy to distinguish because they had this... it was a real, of course, it was a low, wide hood, and it had these dual ram air induction scoops that were set right up near the front of the hood. And if you look at them, you can look at a model or anything of the, you know, the Trans Am and check this out, but that hood design, that hood scoop design was just so cool, and it's so distinctive for that first year, and along with the white and blue paint scheme, which, by the way, was a nod, to the what was called America's International Sports Car Racing Color Scheme. So, you know, when we went racing overseas, we used this white with blue stripes paint scheme, and it was undeniably, you know, the American paint scheme. And a lot of, well, actually all countries that compete have a paint scheme that they adhere to when they race internationally.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can't be mistaken about this. This became iconic. Even people who don't consider themselves car people will recognize the Trans Am.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of exterior cues that lead them to mm-hmm. differentiate these between a standard Firebird.
And, you know, at this point, Scott, let me ask you. You want to talk a little bit more about the famous Bandit Firebird?
Yeah, let's move on at this point. I mean, I think we've probably exhausted a lot of our information about the 69, clearly, right? too much, maybe. But it is important to know where they come from. But, yeah, I would like to talk about the 1977 Bandit Trans Am, or, you know, a lot of people call it the Bandit Trans Am. Mm-hmm. But let's do that after a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Don't call it a comeback. Well, you could call it a comeback because we just came back. We have looked at the origin of the Firebird and the Trans Am, and we are now exploring in a little more detail the 1977 Pontiac Firebird Trans Am, a.k.a. the Bandit Trans Am, a.k.a. the reason that so many people immediately went out to buy one.
Mm-hmm, that's right. And recently, I think it was somewhere around 2015, 2016, wasn't it? That there was a Barrett Jackson auction in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Yeah.
This is crazy. A 1977 Trans Am that was used to promote the Smokey and the Bandit movie sold for $550,000 at this Barrett Jackson auction, I think it was in January of 2016, I think it was when it was.
Yeah.
Now, this is incredible. I mean, a lot of people really raised their eyebrows when this happened. Now, it was it wasn't one that was actually used in the movie. It was one that was used to promote the movie. That's the difference.
So this would be on a circuit making appearances.
And it's pristine. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's in really, really good condition.
They got a picture of Bert himself leaning on it.
That's right. And I'm sure he signed it somewhere. I'm not, you know, 100% confident of that, but I'm sure he did. A lot of people like to take these older Trans Ams that have been restored, take them to Burt Reynolds and have him sign them, you know, as if they're part of the movie history or something.
Right.
But, you know, this one, I believe this one is signed by him.
It is. Yeah.
All right. And again, I want to point out, I don't know if I said this earlier, but this is not the very first black and gold, combination Trans Am that they created. It is, however, a 1977 special edition Trans Am. It had, you know, the big gold bird on its hood, and it's the car that kind of made, you know, this logo, this big, you know, the Firebird, the screaming chicken, legendary. But, again, it's not the very first one that had the black and gold combination. It was just, maybe the most famous. That's the way we'll put it.
You know, some interesting trivia about this, Scott. This specific promo car is an automatic.
Is it really?
Yeah.
I never paid attention to this. I wonder if the ones used in the film were automatic. I doubt it. They're probably manual transmission.
I doubt it, too.
And I haven't watched the film recently enough to, you know, like to focus in on something like that, but I bet it was a manual transmission. Now, the cars in the movie, of course, we said they were destroyed, right? They were not 1977 model cars, by the way, which I find really interesting. The cars that were provided for them, of course, you know, they shoot these movies early, so they wanted to get out the latest product, and the way to make them, kind of dress them up, they knew what was coming for Pontiac Trans Am early, of course, in the Pontiac division. So they offered up these vehicles that had kind of these, and I won't say prototype, I'll say early production maybe. They took the front ends off of a 1977, and by the front end I just mean that front plastic clip that had the headlights, you know, behind it. They added 1977 front ends to 1976 models. So the cars in the movie were 1976. The differentiation would be, or the main difference would be, that the 76 model had round headlights, where the 1977 model, they were going to switch over to square headlamps. And so when you see them, you spot them, you can know instantly that this is 1977 versus a 76. That's how they could tell. But I find it interesting that they do stuff like that. They allow these early release products. You know, like I don't know if they at the time they were so worried about spy photographers like they are now. Probably not.
Right,
I don't think
yeah.
it was as big a thing as it is now. But apparently they didn't have any problem, you know, letting the people on the studio lot know what the 77s were going to look like.
Yeah. I have a thing that I think is really cool for the listeners, Scott.
Sure.
And I'm trying to figure out if I should let the badger out of the bag now or wait till the end.
Oh, if it's really cool, why don't you hang on to it?
All right.
Just a minute or two, because I've only got a couple more things I want to share.
Okay,
really.
But I've officially foreshadowed this. I promise right. It's cool. I promise it's worth
it. All right, we've got to get to it. We can't forget it.
Right on.
Okay.
I got you.
All right, so here's the thing. I mentioned that it wasn't the very first one. Now, the black and gold paint graphics and the gothic typeface and all that had appeared on earlier Pontiac prototypes, and including a 50th anniversary edition Trans Am that came out in 1976. So, again, the year that they were trying to make look like a 77. What was missing, however, from the 1977 special edition car was the 455 cubic inch engine that had given the earlier cars the street cred. And then in its place, as kind of the top performance engine that was, you know, available, there was this optional 200 horsepower 400 cubic inch V8, which is the famous, the TA 6.6 liter, which, you know, of course was designated by a badge that was on the shaker hood scoop. We didn't even talk about the shaker hood scoop, but the shaker hood scoop was a cool feature too. I love to watch that thing. And my old Trans Am, my own 78, I used to just kind of love to watch that thing rumble as I was driving. It was such a cool feature, I thought. It was non-functional on the one that I had, which was pretty lame, I guess. Really, when you think about it, the earlier ones were functional. By 78, it was non-functional, but just kind of sat on top of the engine. It got the airflow from somewhere else. I probably could have, you know, swapped it out with a functional one, but never did. It was just a neat feature, but it looked really cool with the cutout hood thing. All right, see if I'm digressing here. So the 6.6 was available with either a BorgWarner Super T10 four-speed manual transmission or a turbo hydromatic 350 automatic, except in California, where all the Trans Ams were fitted with a 185 horsepower, 403 cubic inch Oldsmobile V8 and an automatic transmission. So if you were in California, you were just kind of out of luck. You were all the way down to 185 horsepower in this car that, you know, by the way, weighs 3,800 pounds. So it's a heavy car.
Yeah, no kidding.
It's deceptively heavy. It doesn't look all that big. If you stand next to one, it's big now compared to what's on the streets now. But it was deceptively small at the time. But again, 3,800 pounds, that's a heavy car. Lots of metal in that thing. Lots of rusty metal in that thing. Eventually, you know, maybe 2 years after production.
Oh, man, cast iron.
Oh, well, those things were notoriously, I don't know if you want to say not treated or just poorly treated at the factory. So that, you know, and if you're in the Rust Belt, those things, the panels just disintegrated after about 2 or 3 years of salt, you know, on the roads and, you know, just maybe, you know, lack of, you know, rinsing that stuff off, or if you live near the coast, maybe the panels just disappeared on the thing. They were awful, really bad. I'm glad we're past that time now.
Cars
are made so much better now for, you know, rust prevention, rust protection.
Well, material science has just gone leaps and bounds.
It's pretty rare now, pretty rare. Not entirely 100% gone, but it's pretty rare to see a car rusting out like that. A modern car.
Yeah. They're mostly going to be older now just because the coatings are different.
Yeah, and the underlying material is often not metal. But then when it is metal, you would almost have to have an accident or have a scrape that goes so deep that it mars the metal surface. But again, back then it wasn't unusual to see a car that looked like Swiss cheese in the panels. and mine did. You know, the back panels looked like Swiss cheese. They were terrible.
They were getting eaten
just
up. Just
awful. They had the flap in the wind. They were so bad.
Oh, man.
And almost flap in the wind. But they're pretty bad. And again, just different time, different materials, all that. But, okay, so here's the thing. If you're shopping for a Trans Am today, and we're almost done here, so we'll get your moment here, Ben, at the end with the special treat. Special treat, what did you say it was? Maybe a secret? No, not a secret. It was big news?
It's the big news. It's
okay.
A big reveal.
I like special treat.
Special treat sounds like we're going to feed people.
Okay,
I don't want to get anybody hangry.
All right, it's big news. All right, so I guess maybe we could talk just a little bit about current value because that's on a lot of people's minds.
Yeah,
if you want to get
important.
One of these now, and a lot of people do, you know, for nostalgia purposes, or you know, this is the car they had in high school, or they wanted in high school, or whatever. But if they, you know, this article, and I think it's from, it's from Hemmings. Yeah, it's Hemmings Motor News. They say if you're shopping for a 1977 Trans Am today, The good news is that the cars are plentiful enough that you can find a nice example in the $20,000 range and project cars for $8,000 and under, way under in some cases. Now, I would say way under in some cases. Those are the ones that are in the condition like what I had, way under $8,000.
Yeah.
I mean, those are the ones that are rusted out and rotted. You don't want those. But if you're looking for a well-equipped one, you know, that's in great condition, you know, like what they call a show-stopping SE with black interior, four-speed, you know, the 200-horsepower 400, a CB radio. You better be prepared to spend upwards of $40,000, according to popular pricing guides. Now, Hemmings and Edmunds and all those, you know, they kind of weigh in on this about what the price is in just a moment. But there was one that was recently listed in Hemmings. I think it was a 77 Trans Am Special Edition with an automatic transmission, a private seller, and they were asking just under $70,000 for this one.
Sheesh.
And that's not one that was, you know, used to promote the movie or anything, of course. That one goes for $500,000. So the trend, I guess, if you want to look at the trend, since about 2012, the trend is up. In 2016, the value trend was somewhere around $41,300. So they are expensive if you want to pick up one today that's in really good condition. Of course, you can have one restored. You can restore it yourself.
Yeah.
But you know the pitfalls there, you know, that you might end up spending more money to restore it than it would be valued at when you're done. That happens a lot with people. I mean, we don't give advice. We've had somebody write in recently, and if you're listening right now, and I hope you are, just because, you know, you like Trans Ams, like I like Trans Ams, we just don't give that kind of advice. We just can't do it.
It's ultimately up to you. We can, however, as Scott said, give a word of caution going into a restoration project, even if your I's are dotted and your T's are crossed, you know what I mean? Even if you do everything right by the book, extensive research before you get in there, the truth of the matter is that you have no way of predicting what else you might end up, you know, quagmired in.
Well, exactly. And that's why we can't offer the advice. So the question, you know, would be, should I restore it, or should I, you know, buy one that's in poor condition, restore it?
Yeah.
Or should I buy one that's already complete and you know, ready to go? And we just can't answer that question. There's too many variables. So
yeah, and I don't even know if I use the word quagmire correctly. I don't know if you can use it that way.
Yeah, maybe. I think that's right.
Embroiled.
Yeah, that's better.
Bogged like, down.
Yeah, that's better. Even better. Yep. Yeah. All right. So I think I've pretty much exhausted my my Trans Am material, at least what I have in front of me. And I could probably talk for, I don't know, 20 more hours, Ben, about my own experience with my first car, my Trans Am. And I did a little bit on our first car episodes.
You did?
So a little bit more. If you want to, you know, listen to that, that's fine. And there's a lot more to it than that. But
I can't remember. Did you give it a nickname?
No, I did not. I didn't. I've never been one to name my cars.
No?
No, never. I've had friends that have named every car they've ever owned, but yeah. I've never done it myself. You? You ever name a car?
I have in the past, but they haven't been like anthropomorphized kind of names.
Oh, I see.
You know what I mean?
So it's not like, here's Dan, my car.
Yeah. It's not like... you know, Chelsea and I are heading out to Savannah.
Yeah, so you call it like the silver bullet or something like
yeah,
that.
Something cool.
Something cool.
Yeah, or something lame. But
all right, so what's this? This is big news. What are you getting?
Holy smokes, man. I'm glad you asked. I've been on the edge of my seat trying not to spill the beans early, but I was looking into the pricing on these cars too, right?
Yeah.
And you're spot on. A project car you can get in for $8,000, but you really don't know how much it's actually going to cost you to make it drivable.
Okay.
And if you want to get one of the nice ones, one of the, you know, like the premier Burt Reynolds touched it or whatever, farted around it kind of Trans Am, that's going to be like a, you know, that could easily be $500,000. But today, until August 2017, you, Scott, me, Noel, Dylan, everybody listening, everybody can enter into the 40th anniversary 2017 Bandit giveaway.
What's that?
So to promote this, Burt Reynolds is sponsoring a Bandit Trans Am giveaway. It celebrates the 40th anniversary of Smokey and the Bandit. Hmm. So he personalized it more so than just like signing it. He did a bunch of stuff with this. It has a certificate of authenticity. He signed it. You've got the all the custom stuff. It's basically they it's the movie car.
He didn't build the engine or anything, did he? Because he's kind of old. I wonder if
he smelted the iron himself.
I mean, I like Burt Reynolds. Don't get me wrong, but I just don't know if he's a skilled engine builder at this point in his life.
So.
You're ignoring the whole thing.
No, I backed you up. I just smelled metal, Joe.
No, fine.
I thought it was a good joke, Scott.
Thank you. I needed that validation. I needed validation.
So the grand prize is one 1977 Pontiac Trans Am, customized to the hilt, one Stetson hat.
Okay.
Some more memorabilia for the Trans Am that I think they just put in the car. Mm-hmm. And $15,000 to go toward paying Uncle Sam, the IRS.
All right. Makes sense, right?
It's weird because remember when Oprah gave away all those cars?
Oh, yeah.
And it was this huge controversy because all of a sudden these people had this tax bill?
It was a disaster.
It was a disaster, but we all learned something.
Yeah, we did, especially the people in the audience.
So if you want a Trans Am, you have until August 29th, 217. Look at me, 2017. To go to www.dreamgiveaway.com and search for the Bandit car.
And we're not associated with this in any way,
nope.
So whatever happens, happens. But I might enter that myself. I'd love to win that car. I think there's other stuff going on, too. There's a company that is taking 2017 Camaros and changing them into Trans Ams. There's a body switchover. Engine changes going on. I only looked at this for 2 or 3 minutes. It looked like it was really impressive. I want to say that the numbers were like over $100,000 for the car. Plus you have to give them the donor car. The new model,
mm-hmm.
Camaro. But there are body switches that go on. There's engine changes, and I think that the price was or the horsepower was somewhere around like 840 if you went for the top end. Optional package that they mm-hmm. had. They offered it was a supercharged version,
mm-hmm.
840 horsepower, and I think it was like 730 pound-feet of torque at the wheels. So these are really strong, strong vehicles.
Yeah.
The factory that's doing this, I think it's in Florida, if I remember. They wouldn't allow the person that was doing the show, the review of these vehicles, to drive any of them because every single one of them is a custom order. Someone has delivered that to be built, and they just couldn't allow it to go out on the road that way. So they had kind of a factory test vehicle that was a little bit under power compared to the big version that they make, the most expensive monster version. So you couldn't really drive that one, but it looked very impressive, and I think they look really cool. I know I've seen the Trans Am on the auto show circuit. I think it was just even last year.
Yeah.
Looked really good, the modern Trans Am. Maybe it's nostalgia, Ben, but I would buy one. I would. It's so unique. It's so interesting looking. I would get one. I know it's flashy.
I might get tired of it.
Yeah, I might get tired of it, but I think it's a cool thing to have.
It'd be great to take it on a road rally.
Oh, it sure would.
Which brings us to some our big reveal. We mentioned that we went out with a Rally North America to the Ohio Valley 700 with a lot of crucial help from our friend and longtime listener, Glenn Beck.
Yeah, this was late in 2016.
And we ended up making a documentary about it with our fantastic crew. And it is now online. It's live. You can check it out on Amazon. But wait, Ben, you might be saying, I don't have Amazon Prime. Well, have no worries. You can watch it for free.
Yeah, everybody gets to watch it for free, regardless if you have a Prime account or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we just want you to check it out. It is a look at, in some ways, a very humbling look at at our very first road rally and our experience learning the ropes.
Yeah, and this is a long form program.
It's a documentary.
I'll tell you, and I'm going to toot our own horn here just a little bit, but this is no YouTube video, Ben. This looks this looks really nice. I'm super pleased with the way this turned out. I'm really happy. I don't want to say surprised by it because I knew what we were creating was quality. You know, we have good equipment here at the studio to use, but to see that on a big screen, it's really impressive. I mean, it looks nice. I think fans of Car Stuff are really going to dig this video. Check it out. It's called the Great North American Road Rally,
mm-hmm.
and you can find it on the House. All you have to do is search "How Stuff Works," and it'll come up.
Yeah, yeah. And so we wanted to thank our fantastic crew that put it together. We had Casey and our producer Noel went with us, and then we also we had our friend and coworker Chandler edit this, and Tyler. Everybody put a little bit of their blood, sweat, and tears in this thing.
Oh, definitely, yeah. So. And we're super happy with the end product. It's really, really, I feel it's really, really nice. Take a look at it and see what you think, too.
Yeah.
And I'd love to get some reviews.
Yeah, I want to get back out on the road, and if I win a Firebird, I hope you don't resent me, Scott, because I'm going to go on a road rally.
Hey, I'm going to put a link up on our Facebook page at some point to
okay.
that. And I hope it comes, I hope that link appears before this episode airs. But if it doesn't, just go to Amazon and search for Amazon Video and search "How Stuff Works" for the road rally, and you'll find it. And again, tell us what you think. We'd love to hear.
And while you're online, if you want to check out any of the other audio episodes we've ever done, then you are in luck. You can go to carstuffshow.com. Check out every single one. I don't know. We don't even really keep track of how many there are.
No,
right now. It always sneaks up on us.
Yeah, yeah. No telling.
We'll figure it out before we get to 1,000. How about that?
I don't know. That's a big promise.
That we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And somebody just write in and tell us when we accidentally hit that number. And you can also, as Scott said, check out our Facebook and Twitter where we are CarStuffHSW. And our last biggest thank you goes to Brisket T for the excellent suggestion.
Oh, we call him Brisket Turner.
We call him Brisket Turner?
Yeah, Brisket Turner, but we'll call him Andrew S. How about that?
Okay. Brisket Turner, a.k.a. Andrew S., thank you. Thank you immensely. We thought this was a fascinating topic, and there's a lot of stuff here. And you might have just got me a free car, man. Or yourself.
Maybe.
So thank you so much. And if you would like to take a page from Brisket's book and write to us directly with an idea for something we should cover in the future, your own stories about Firebird or, you know, Burt Reynolds, we're open. We'd love to hear from you. Our best ideas come from you. So write to us directly. We are
CarStuff@HowStuffWorks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.